This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast, and we're back again, me and my archival diver, Dave, to continue our discussion about profitability and open source with a little focus on HashiCorp. And when we last left this story last week, HashiCorp was kind of in a situation of some very recognizable brands like Kleenex or Duct Tape or Google, where people didn't say, we're going to do stuff with infra as code. No, they were terraforming it.
Yeah.
So what went
exactly
wrong?
Exactly right. Well, I mean, you know, not necessarily wrong, but it just...
A bit of drama happens.
Well, if we will pause our little history journey so far, and we'll maybe talk a little bit about Terraform, because exactly as you said, everyone's doing it, and... you know, all the cloud providers have kind of put time and effort into making sure that they've got their own Terraform providers so you can easily deploy their technology. And in fact, you know, there's a bunch of kind of wild statistics if you go and look at the various Terraform providers. Like the AWS one, there was I found a blog post in 2022 that was talking about the Terraform AWS Terraform provider, just that single provider, had been downloaded 1.3 billion times, of which half of those downloads, because it was still relatively new at that point, had occurred in 2022 on its own. Like, it's just wild how active and how prolific Terraform was. Or was and is, I should say.
So 1 in 8 people in the world downloaded it.
Exactly. Or maybe a bunch of automated systems downloaded a lot. But maybe it was. Maybe it was 1 in every 8 people just thought, do you know what? That AWS Terraform provider sounds cool. I should go and take a look at that. Entirely possible. You know, some other sort of, I guess, kind of interesting, at least they were to me, sort of numbers. So some of you out there may well be familiar with the Terraform registry. So this is the sort of the shopping store, if you like, for how do you want to, you know, what are the technologies that you want to manage? And there are, so there's the concept of providers. So these are usually, you know, organizations or, you know, an entire product portfolio, if you like. And there are over 5,000 of these providers. You know, yes, all the major ones are reflected, AWS, Azure, GCP, but also, you know, Kubernetes, you know, you name it, there's probably a provider for it. You know, you can get your Akamai, you can get your VMware vSphere, you can get your Alibaba Cloud Stack. Like, there's literally 5,000 of these things that exist out there. And you've also got 19,000 modules. So the modules are like the individual subcomponents of each of the major providers. So things like the Terraform AWS sort of provider, you know, there's a module that all that module does is allows you to, you know, create or change IAM resources, or there's another one that allows you to, you know, configure or change or update or delete VPC resources, or there's another one for S3 buckets, and, you know, I'm sure you get the picture at this point. But it's just a crazy number of, I'm not familiar with any other sort of infrastructure as code platform that's got this wide an ecosystem of you know, largely community contributed resources that you can literally just plug and play, plug and go.
Yeah, but that's the first player advantage, right? I mean, if there's nobody else, people will integrate with you, and that will give you the advantage that you can push through. Everybody else needs to play catch-up at that point. And that's why not always the best solution survives. I mean, the best solution to use is the one that's more used more broadly, because then you will have upgradability, maintainability, sustainability, stability in general, basically. While there might be some startup that has something great that's better, but it's a bit niche and less. So yeah, I mean, once you have that mass running, you kind of become unstoppable.
Yeah. And you know, if you're an ISV and you want to provide an as code solution for your customers,
you want to make it easy.
You want to make it easy. You don't want to make them, or you shouldn't want to make them, learn your own bespoke, weird, custom method of configuring thing. Just embrace what everyone else is doing. That's
somebody should tell D4J that, but that's a side point.
Oh God, please no. Anyway, there's some other. I remember probably at least 3 years ago now. I was chatting to a reasonably senior AWS exec, and I haven't been able to find any stats on this, any information on this. So, you know, take this with a large bucket of salt if you feel the need to. But when I was talking about Terraform support with this particular AWS exec that I shall not name, they mentioned that easily the majority of cloud spend is orchestrated by Terraform. Like it's not even quite a lot of it is. He wouldn't say exactly, but he gave the impression, or me reading between the lines, gave the impression it's somewhere in the, I don't know, somewhere between there's like 70 to 80% of what happens on AWS is orchestrated in Terraform. And that is wild to me that one technology has such presence. And this is me reading between the lines, the conversation with one individual. You know, maybe they got the numbers wrong. Maybe I misinterpreted things, but you know, that's the conversation that I had with that individual.
Yeah, I mean, I have no reason to disbelieve you, but I wouldn't be surprised if this was part of the problem. I mean, this is kind of where the problem started for HashiCorp, because around that time I was at Microsoft and Azure was doing its thing. And now, there was never a corporate directive or decision or something official like that, but Azure tried very hard not to have their people use Terraform. Because, and I would think Google has done the same thing to a lesser degree, Google Cloud is much smaller. But for me, what I understood there was that if people are using Terraform, they can switch, and Azure also standardizes and makes it easy and useful to use Terraform. Hybrid cloud becomes easy. People can go from Google, from Amazon to Azure and back again, and you don't get the stickiness that a hyperscaler typically wants. And that's why, in my opinion, Azure really went for the Azure manifest files and then the Azure CLI to do their infrastructure as code, really to distanciate them from Terraform and to make it, well, harder for people to leave. And that may sound as anti-competitive, but it is very normal. If I have customers, I want to keep my customers, can do that in two ways, by offering a better product. And you kind of have to do that, right? So you don't keep people in for your product for a bad price, or to make it too much of a hassle to go to a competing, similarly valued product. And for HashiCorp to be so tightly associated, if that's the right word, with Amazon, kind of hurt them in the end. And there are other companies out there that have the same problem. I think Databricks, for example, in more recent years also has affiliated them enormously with Azure. And that is also hurting them, because the other hyperscalers, which are huge movers and shakers, I mean, they have a lot of influence on what tools you will be using in the end. If you can't be buddies with all three big ones, you will be losing out here or there. That's just kind of inevitable.
Yeah, maybe. I never saw that side of things. So I can, again,
I was on the dark side.
No reason, I have no reason to disbelieve you. So I guess we're even on that. All right. So we're going to restart the history journey now with another kind of major milestone here. And that is that in 2021, HashiCorp went through their IPO. So they started off with $80 a share or thereabouts, and very briefly they sort of went up by about 15%. Here we have some lovely graphs, and this particular one was taken from, let's see if I can find the name of the article. I can't. We'll have a link in the notes, I'm sure. But
this is the article on the screen now, so you can see it's
There we go. A Medium article. There we go. So this was sort of a bit of a cluster, as you can see by the graph here. So yes, they had an initial peak of value, but by the time, a year later in 2022, their share price had lost nearly 80% of its value, dropping all the way down into the $20 range. And we're gonna get to a little bit of why it looks like all this happened, and it's a mixture of things. There's definitely a case to be made that they just set a crazy aggressive price in the first place, and there was a huge spike post IPO, because one of the reasons for the IPO is usually to get a huge amount of more cash into the business to then scale that business even further. The goal for a lot of these organizations is to reach that escape velocity where the numbers cross over. We'll talk about those numbers in a minute, and the world is a happy, shiny, wonderful place. This did not go well for HashiCorp in this particular case.
Yeah, I don't remember anymore, but was this one of the first IPOs that really didn't do well from the start? Because, the whole reason of going IPO, because it was in the past, you had a good idea, you went to the stock market, and you became a billionaire overnight, and things were great forevermore. And it was the dot-com bubble, that was way before, obviously. But at some point, IPOs just became something much more risky, because there had been a couple of bad apples. I'm not going to go and calling any names here, not need for that. But people became more careful. And if you look at today's 2025 geopolitical landscape, IPOs are almost not done anymore, because people basically don't trust that they will make money. And a lot of companies have been waiting to go for the IPO for the last 3-4 years, maybe. It's just not been a good climate anymore. And HashiCorp being 2021, 2022, it feels like that was, and again, this is just my memory trying to be active, like that was kind of the place where things started to not be an automatic success, but become a risky thing. So their valuation of $80, it's not something they decided upon themselves. Typically, these companies go into bed with some kind of financial institution, Morgan Chase, I don't know, big bank companies that do analysis, blah, 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 future prospecting. And then dictate based on past experience, which is, as a small print says, no guarantee for the future, put a price on that. And I'd say we shouldn't be too harsh on HashiCorp here and saying that they botched it up. They got this number from somewhere, and I can imagine in 2021, 2022, this sounded like, yeah, that sounds okay.
Yeah, maybe. Certainly I talk a lot about the reality distortion bubble all the time. And there's maybe these folks were in the reality, their own reality distortion bubble when they were setting that price. Maybe their expectations was that, you know, this could only go up and to the right, as they say.
And again, stock price going down doesn't mean company loses money. I mean, they made a bundle when they went public, and with $80, $100 valuation, we don't have the amount of shares sold in the graph we just showed, but they probably got the cash infusion they wanted at the start. And even if the stock is running at $20 now, people buying and selling those shares doesn't make any difference at all for the company, because you're not buying the company shares, you're selling them amongst stockholders. So of course, there's a image thing. If your stock tanks like this, people will talk badly about you. But it doesn't really hurt their bottom line up until the point that they want to issue more stock to have a bigger cash infusion again. Of course, then you can't say we want $80 again, because no, it's proven now it's only valid $20. Yeah. So there's an issue there. But apart from that, this graph does not mean HashiCorp went bankrupt or into big problems. It's just that it shows that their valuation was not as high as they imagined it would be. So there was a bit of self-delusion happening there. That's kind of the worst thing you can say about this.
Yeah, agreed. So, you know, the IPO happened in 2021. The value of the company had dropped by 80% as far as the stock market is concerned by 2022. And then in 2023, the next big milestone in HashiCorp's history happened, which was the relicensing of their open source projects into the BSL or Business Source License. This was a very, very challenging time, I would say, for HashiCorp. And this, you know, there are organizations that have gone through license changes. Some of them, it goes quite well. Others, it does not go so well. We won't, you know, necessarily call those organizations out right now. You probably know who we're talking about in those different scenarios.
That's when Oracle went open source, right?
No. Pass. But I think it's fair to say, you know, we are talking about HashiCorp, and I think it's fair to say that this is one that did not go well, was not received well, was not handled well.
Can I suggest that we keep this one for the next episode? Because we're again running up into the 20 minutes, which is what we kind of want to go on. And I think this whole license change is a big meaty subject that I prefer not to slice into.
Okay, we can do that. We can do that.
So any words on
I mean, the final thing I would say is, you know, even out of trying traumatic times, you know, there are positive things that happen, and we'll be getting more into that later, perhaps talking a little bit about some non-meat-based protein open things.
I'm going to talk about bland stuff. Okay, take it away.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So, more about things like open tofu, in case you just didn't get the reference.
I gave it away. I had a cliffhanger all built up, and he just gives it away.
You know, you've got to give the audience what they want. And what they want is definitely the fact that it's all the time we have for today. You can support this podcast by becoming a Patreon. Every contribution really does help. We are on YouTube. You can like, subscribe, hit that notification bell, do all the YouTube things. You can also go to roaringelephant.org for a link to our Patreon page and for more information about the podcast. Please also send any feedback you have to podcast@roaringelephant.org. But until next time, my name is No Cliffhangers Dave.
And my name is Super Meat Boy Yon.
And we look forward to talking to you next week.
Goodbye.
See you then.